Citizen Soldiers, Disc 9.
That was one of many attacks launched on Christmas Day, by both sides. They were there to kill, holy day or not. On the front, the dead and dying were all around them. Sergeant Egger recalled an attack his company made on a German-occupied village late on the afternoon of Christmas Eve. German machine guns hit the advancing GIs. 2 men were wounded, 1 killed. The platoon dug in. A wounded man kept crying, "Mother, mother, help me," as he struggled to rise. Another burst from the machine gun silenced him. That beseeching plea on that clear, cold Christmas night will remain with me for the rest of my life. Shortly after midnight, the company resumed the attack. It advanced to a frozen ditch beside the road, where it attracted concentrated German machine gun fire. The men threw themselves into the ditch, where they remained stretched out prone on the frozen snow for 6.5 hours. They began to fall asleep. Lieutenant Ott crawled back to them several times, shaking them awake and making them kick their feet and flex their hands and fingers. At dawn, the Germans counterattacked. They were repulsed. Then the Americans tried again. "We lost several men that day who would not have been hit if they had been given any infantry training," Ott commented. "One of my men was killed while standing up firing when he should have been lying flat in the snow. I saw him and yelled at him to get down, but he couldn't hear me." It was a Christmas that left Ott and his men stunned and haunted. Sergeant D. Zane Schlemmer of the 82nd Airborne recalled a scene of total black and white, the whiteness of the snowy fields in stark contrast to the darkness of the forests and the long column of troopers struggling under the weight of their total possessions. Through Christmas Eve night and on into Christmas Day, Schlemmer's company was marching to the rear to take up new positions. The paratroopers hated to give up ground, but they were in a salient, and the brass decided to shorten the line. The men were sure the Germans would attempt to attack before they got dug in. So when dawn came, Schlemmer and his buddies were feverishly grubbing in the rocky, frozen, root-bound soil. In a near frenzy, they set up their weapons, stashed supplies of ammo, placed anti-tank mines. Snow began to fall, masking the line. Canteens of water froze. The troopers sat in their holes, straining to hear and see. Darkness came around 16:30. The outposts reported that a large force of Germans was approaching. Then, in Schlemmer's words, "Out of the night, through the falling snow, came the German columns trudging in their heavy coats, rifles slung over their shoulders along the road, some talking, some smoking, all completely oblivious to the paratroopers dug in mere yards away. The wait for the signal to open fire seemed endless. When it came, the firefight was intense and devastating. The falling snow mercifully covered the remains of the 2 German battalions that in that short time ceased to exist." The American paratroopers went out into the field the next day to retrieve usable weapons. They found a wicker basket carried on a pole between 2 German soldiers. It contained a tub of butter. When they returned to their lines, they found that the cooks had brought up some ice-cold coffee and sliced roast turkey, solidly frozen. Their Christmas meal had arrived a day late. They used the butter to heat the turkey over small fires at the bottoms of their foxholes. "No finer Christmas dinner has ever been," Sergeant Schlemmer remarked. On December 21st, Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Hogan's task force of 17 tanks, 2 half-tracks, and about 400 men had been cut off in the village of Marcouray on the northern shoulder of the Bulge. It was a pocket-sized baston. Hogan's parent division, the 3rd Armored, was too hard-pressed to attempt to rescue. Ammunition, rations, medical supplies were short or gone. An attempt to shoot in plasma using artillery shells didn't work. Hogan's men had to endure without fresh supplies or reinforcements for the next 2 days. At noon on Christmas Eve, a German jeep approached Marcouret under a white flag. A lieutenant speaking English demanded that Hogan surrender. He said resistance was useless as three panzer divisions surrounded the village, and added that he was authorized to take an American officer on a tour of the German positions. Hogan replied, "We have orders to hold out to the end. Tell your commander to go to hell." That afternoon, seven C-47 aircraft tried to drop supplies to Task Force Hogan, which by now had caught the reporters' attention and was being called in the newspapers Hogan's 400. German 88s got six of the seven, and the supplies that were dropped came down outside the village. The beneficiaries were the Germans and the farmers. The following day, just as Hogan was finishing his Christmas dinner of cold K-rations, Major General Maurice Rose, the much-admired and loved CO of the 3rd Armored, radioed orders to Hogan to destroy his heavy weapons and vehicles and get out on foot. The men set to draining the oil from the engines, then running them until they froze up, putting sugar in the gasoline and dropping breech blocks into a well. Captain Louis Spiegelman, the surgeon, and several of his medics volunteered to stay with the wounded. The less seriously wounded guarded the German prisoners, knowing that roles would reverse when the German force moved in. At 16:30, small groups began to move out. Hogan was with the last group to leave at 18:30. The American lines were 10 miles away on a straight line. Hogan was wearing fleece-lined British flying boots, not made for walking through snow. To his dismay, he had to stop his group to rest. Not until dawn did the first units reach Friends. Hogan was the last to arrive at 1400 December 26th. When he reported to General Rose, Rose wanted to know why he was the last man out. Hogan thought of several heroic answers he might give, but decided instead to tell the truth. "My feet hurt." Private Philip Stark was a 19-year-old machine gunner in the 84th Division. He arrived on Christmas Eve at a position outside the Belgian village of Verdun in the northern shoulder of the Bulge. His company had been on the offensive for a month, and as a result lost 175 out of the original 200 men. Replacements had brought it back to strength. "Upon arrival in this sector," Stark wrote 3 years later, recording his experiences on paper for fear of forgetting details, "we were told no prisoners. They didn't say, 'Shoot any German who surrenders,' but there was no alternative. Our forces were spread thin. We had no one to take care of those who surrendered or were wounded. Few people back home were aware of or could understand the necessity of the thing." At twilight, the German troops in Verdun began to celebrate. Sounds and songs carried well across the cold, clear air. Too well for Stark's safety. Officers at regimental level heard the songs and decided to give the Germans a reminder of Washington crossing the Delaware to attack the Hessian troops on Christmas Eve, 1776. Stark's platoon was ordered to attack and drive the Germans from the town. That meant going up a hill. In the dark, the company got to the top, only to be shelled by American artillery. Stark and his buddy Wibb tried to dig in, but below the frozen earth there was rock. They were digging from the prone position, and despite frantic efforts, when dawn came, "Our hole was only about a foot deep and 6 feet long. Wibb was 6'2", and I'm 6'6", but at least we were able to keep ourselves below the all-important ground level. This is how we spent Christmas Eve in 1944. Christmas morning, Stark got to talking to Wibb about the stories he had heard or read from the First World War, when on Christmas the frontline soldiers would declare a truce. We longed for a lull, for a day of peace and safety. Instead, they got a German barrage, intended to cover the retreat of German vehicles from Verdun. Stark began cutting down fleeing enemy infantry. Only on this Christmas day did I ever find combat to be as pictured in the movies. We blazed away ruthlessly. This action could not be understood or accepted by persons not having combat experience. At dawn the following day, German infantry and tanks counterattacked. The remainder of the platoon retreated, but Stark stayed with his machine gun, even when Wibb took a bullet in the middle of his forehead. Now I was alone, and for the first time I was sure that I was going to die. But I kept on firing, hoping to keep them off. By now, three enemy tanks were very close and firing their machine guns and cannon directly at my position. I was nearing the end of my second box of ammunition. A German bullet ricocheted off his machine gun, broke into bits, and slammed into his left cheek, blinding him in the left eye. He ran to the rear, only to bump up against a burning German tank. Then over the hill and back to where he had started 3 days ago on Christmas Eve. He had lost an eye and won a Silver Star. In his sector, nothing had been gained by either side in this series of attacks and counterattacks. One thing about life in a foxhole, you had a front row seat for the sensory pleasure of seeing the enemy get pounded by American artillery and airplanes. The sights of war are spectacular. Shells bursting, buildings blazing, tracers filling the sky. There is nothing in civilian life to compare. The infantry were in the front row for aerial battles as well, which could also be spectacular and could catch up the emotions as nothing else. Air battles over the front lines had something of a football game atmosphere. The Germans on the far side cheering their boys overhead, the Americans on their side doing the same. But, of course, it was not a game. On Christmas Day, Captain Cooper witnessed considerable air action. It began shortly after dawn. The sky was crystal clear. He could see flight after flight of B-17s flying at 20,000 feet, headed for the enemy rear. It was indeed a welcome sight. It was Saint Lô all over again. The lead squadron was trailing those long contrails like a series of diamond necklaces in the sky. German fighters appeared. They went for the lead plane. Cooper was holding his breath. My fascination turned to horror as suddenly the lead plane literally exploded in midair. The Germans were armed with rockets. They could stay just far enough behind their target to be out of range of the 50-caliber machine guns of the tail gunner. Cooper thought, "The accuracy of these rocket-firing German fighters, amazing!" Another plane got hit. A bomb in the bay exploded, cutting the plane in half. A third plane lost an entire wing. Two others had engines set on fire and started spiraling like wounded birds struck with flaming arrows. These spirals became tighter and tighter as the planes plunged headlong down to earth. Cooper didn't want to watch, but the sight was magnetic. 5 out of 12 planes were shot down. All across the sky, parachutes began popping open. Cooper counted 25. Debris plummeted downward. Landing gears, engines, pieces of wing, parts of the fuselage, and, of course, the bombs. Even though unarmed, some of the bombs exploded on impact. One B-17, more or less intact, crashed into the ground. The explosion was unbelievable as the gasoline and the 6-ton bomb load went off. A column of flame and debris erupted some 1,000 feet into the air, scattering parts in all directions. Cooper and others noted a piece of broken wing descending on a parachutist some 500 feet from the ground. The men on the ground screamed and waved frantically to get him to slip his chute to one side, but without luck. The wing sheared the parachute in half, and dropped the airman to his death. Another parachutist was headed straight for Cooper's position. A German ME-109 dove at him, his machine guns wide open. Again, the guys on the ground screamed and hollered and waved their arms. He saw them, and by kicking violently, slipped his chute to one side, and the pilot missed him. The pilot made a wide turn and came back for another pass. By this time, the parachutist was much lower, and the pilot was so intent on killing him that he misjudged and crashed into the side of a quarry, killing himself with a terrible explosion. The medics brought in the parachutist. He was a bombardier and was uninjured, except for a frozen foot. He had kicked off his flying boot when he was slipping his chute. On Christmas Eve, Private Joe Tatman of the 9th Armored found himself with his squad hiding in a hayloft outside Baston, well within German lines. They had been trapped there 5 days and had run out of food. But we talked about Christmas and home, never giving up our hopes. At 1600, the Germans found Tatman's group and forced it to surrender. A captain took charge. He had been a lawyer in New York. He explained that he had returned to his homeland to settle his father's estate and got caught up in the war. He took the prisoners into the kitchen of the farmhouse. His cooks were preparing for a Christmas party. He gave the GIs milk and donuts. He talked and joked about the war. He hoped it would end soon so that everyone could go home. After they ate, the captain gave the Americans hot water, towels, and shaving materials. He told them to shave and wash up, as he was inviting them to join the Christmas party. The elderly Belgian couple had set a large, beautiful table in a decorated dining room, covered with all kinds of food and drinks, including meats. There were plates holding all brands of American cigarettes. After eating, the two sides joined in singing. The prisoners sang Silent Night in English. The captors sang it in German. The captain offered a toast of good luck to the prisoners. He explained that he and his men wanted to give the party because they realized that in the morning, Christmas Day, the GIs would begin their journey to hell. Hell was a German POW camp. By late December, they were growing rapidly as the GIs captured in the first days of the Bulge began to come in. The trip from Belgium to the camps in eastern Germany was purgatory. Private Vonnegut of the 106th had a typical experience. After his group was forced to surrender, the Germans marched the POWs 60 miles to Limburg. There was no water, food, or sleep. In Limburg, they were marched to the railroad yard and loaded onto 40 and 8s. French railway cars from World War I designed to hold 40 men or 8 horses. The Germans crowded 60 men into Vonnegut's car. Private Ian Morrison's car held 100 men. The cars were unventilated and unheated. There were no sanitary accommodations. In Vonnegut's car, half the men had to stand so the other half could lie down to sleep. In Morrison's car, no one could lie down. In every car, there were any number of men with severe dysentery. There they stayed for 4 days. Shortly after dark on Christmas Eve, in Morrison's car, the only sounds were the moaning of our comrades within our box and those fore and aft of us. In one of those cars, a man began singing. He obviously had a trained voice. He was a superb tenor, Private George Zack recalled. He sang Silent Night. Soon the others in the car took it up. It spread to the cars up and down the line. The German guards joined in the singing. Suddenly the air raid sirens went off. Soon bombs from the RAF were dropping all around the railroad yard. "Let us out!" the POWs screamed as they pounded on the locked siding doors. "For Christ's sake, give us a chance!" But the guards had run off. The thinnest man in the car managed to squeeze through one of the vent windows and removed the wire locking the sliding door. The POWs poured out and ran up and down the track, opening the wire on the other cars. They saw a cave-like gully and ran to it. Some made it, but about 150 got killed or wounded. When the all-clear sounded, the guards returned, rounded up the prisoners, and put them back in the cars. It was still dark. Slowly, the excited talk died down as the adrenaline drained. Soon, it was a silent night. "Hey!" someone called out. "Hey, Tenor! Give us some more!" A voice from the other end of the car responded, "He ain't here. He got killed." So it went on the Western Front during the Christmas season, 1944. Christmas Eve at the Flossenbürg POW camp in Bavaria was a macabre experience. A few days earlier, 15 American paratroopers captured in Holland in September had escaped from the camp, but they were caught on December 23rd and returned to Flossenbürg. There, the SS guards held a sadistic Christmas party for the inmates, who were compelled to stand in ranks and watch as the guards hanged the recaptured paratroopers. Out on the English Channel, the transport Leopoldville, a converted luxury liner, was headed toward Le Havre, bringing 2,223 replacements for the Battle of the Bulge. The officers were from the Royal Navy. The crew was Belgian. The passengers were Americans. A fine show of Allied unity. 19-year-old Sergeant Henry Anderson and 150 others went up to the deck just before midnight to sing Christmas carols. There was a boom. A torpedo fired from a U-boat had hit amidships. The ship shivered, then began to sink. The officers and crew jumped into the lifeboats, there were only 14 of them, and took off, leaving the U.S. soldiers to fend for themselves. Anderson managed to jump from the Leopoldville to the deck of a destroyer that came alongside. Others who tried the same missed and were crushed as big waves pushed the two ships into each other. Still others drowned or succumbed to hypothermia. Altogether, 802 GIs died in the incident, but not one British officer or Belgian seaman died. Bad show for Allied unity. The incident, therefore, was covered up. There was no investigation, no court-martial. The Leopoldville Christmas Eve disaster was a consequence of the difficulties the Allies had created for themselves with their inadequate replacement policy, and of the problems the Germans had caused for them in the Ardennes. The Allies were sending every available man across the channel on every available boat. The Leopoldville was one of them. Built to carry 360 passengers, it held 2,223 troops and a crew of 237, including 93 natives of the Belgian Congo, with 24 British seamen to man the guns, and a Belgian captain who spoke only Flemish. She was more a ferry than a transport and was badly run down. "What a hell of a looking boat," Private Leo Zarnowski said. "I don't think we'll make it across. Let's swim." It was early winter, a time when the channel is always rough and often stormy. The German U-boats posed another threat. On December 23rd, a troop carrier had been hit by a torpedo in the channel outside Cherbourg. But it was a short trip to Cherbourg, half a day, and the troops were needed at the front immediately. To speed the process, ordinary precautions were neglected. Lifeboats were not hung over the side, ready for instant use. There were insufficient life jackets, and no instructions on their use were given to those who got one. With men packed into the very bowels of the ship, there were no lifeboat or abandoned ship drills. There were many other screw-ups, most caused by haste. The rescue effort was a disgrace. As a result, what should have been a minor loss, the Leopoldville, was the equivalent of losing a full-strength rifle regiment, as the 1,400 or so survivors had to be sent to the hospital rather than the front line when they finally got to Cherbourg. The survivors don't talk much about it. Lieutenant Bill Everhard commented, "Along with many others, I have tried for almost 50 years to bury my memories of a night of fear, terror, and grief." He adds with some bitterness, "All of us have been helped in this attempt to forget by the governments of the United States, Great Britain, and Belgium." The American cover-up continued until 1959, when the Office of the U.S. Inspector General released a sanitized summary of its 1945 top-secret report. It charged that the Belgian crew were negligent in performance of their duties. They were not at their posts instructing passengers, reporting condition of the ship, and launching lifeboats. They seemed interested only in themselves. The report also noted that had an abandoned ship order been given over the loudspeaker system, undoubtedly many would have been saved. Actually, such an order was given in Flemish. Only the Belgian crew members understood it. The report found no American responsibility and made no mention of the hurry-up, almost frantic nature of the transport system to meet the crisis of the bulge. The British Admiralty's Board of Inquiry report was released in the 1960s. It exonerated the ship's officers and crew. The Belgian government, in 1992, issued its report, which praised the officers and crew and claimed that the lifeboats were put to sea with GIs aboard. The incident has never received the attention given to the somewhat similar disaster at Slapton Sands before D-Day, although the loss of life was about the same, and although the cover-up was more thorough and lasted longer. The main reason is that three governments are involved, but perhaps in some part it is because of when it happened. It is just too painful to think about. Asked for his story, Private George Baker, a survivor, replied, "That Christmas Eve, when I, with so many others, jumped into the sea, filled with, oh, so many boys crying out to God and Mother, it's just something that I do not want to recall." At the front, Lieutenant Charles Stockel, a forward artillery observer for the 2nd Division, had two unforgettable experiences on Christmas Day. He was at Elsinbourne Ridge. Late on Christmas Eve, he was at a company HQ in a cellar. At about 23:45 hours, the firing died down. At the stroke of midnight, without an order or a request, dark figures emerged from the cellars. In the frosty gloom, voices were raised in the old familiar Christmas carols. The heavy snowflakes fell softly, covering the weapons and signs of war. The infantry in their front line positions could hear voices 200 yards away in the dark, joining them, in German, in the words to Silent Night. It was a time when all men could join in the holy and sacred memories of the story of the Christ child and renew a fervent prayer for peace, goodwill toward men. Within an hour, the shooting started. By daylight, it was going full blast. The company's position was easily spotted from the air because of panels on the ground at the crossroads, and the sky had cleared. Nevertheless, two P-47s came in on strafing runs. No one was hurt, but one pilot turned and made a second run, this time dropping his 100-pound bomb on the mess tent where 100 men were eating. There were many casualties. Stockel felt there was no excuse, especially for the second run. Those were his men lying dead and wounded under the bits of canvas. He was infuriated to the point that, "I put 75 rounds from a truck-mounted 50-cal MG through his motor. He went up in flames. He rolled his plane and parachuted. We jumped in a Jeep and were fully intent on beating him to death. He came down, fortunately for him, next to the division MPs. We were told he was cashiered." For that pilot, as for so many others on the Western Front in 1944, it was a Christmas best forgotten. Patton woke on Christmas morning, looked at the sky, and said to himself, "Lovely weather for killing Germans." But to his disappointment, the spearhead 4th Armored Division for his thrust north to relieve Baston failed to break the siege that day. That evening, Patton had Christmas dinner with Bradley at Bradley's headquarters in Luxembourg City. Bradley had spent the day with Montgomery, who had told him that Eisenhower's insistence on an immediate counterattack against the base of the German salient was impossible. It would take weeks for U.S. First Army to be able to reorganize itself and prepare an attack. Patton thought Montgomery's statements were disgusting. The next morning, 4th Armored moved out, with the 37th Tank Battalion, 20 Sherman strong, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Creighton Abrams, in the lead. Yabos, P-47s, preceded them, laying bombs into the German lines only a couple of hundred meters ahead of the advancing tanks. Abrams's orders were to go this way, then that, to more or less sneak through the German lines encircling Baston. But he took it on himself to seize an opportunity and drive straight ahead. He felt a strong urgency because he could see C-47s dropping supplies into Baston, taking heavy flak from the German 88s around the circle. The P-47s hit the village in Abrams's path, finishing up their bombing run just as the first tanks came into the town. "Keep moving," Abrams ordered. They did. And at 1650, December 26th, Lieutenant Charles Bogus drove the first vehicle from 4th Armored into the lines of the 101st Airborne. He was followed by Captain William Dwight. "How are you, General?" Dwight asked General McAuliffe, who had driven out to the perimeter to greet him. "Gee, I'm mighty glad to see you," McAuliffe replied. With the siege of Baston broken, with Piper and the others in retreat, with the bad weather continuing, the week after Christmas was relatively quiet on the front. But to the rear, American trucks were rushing reinforcements and supplies forward, preparing for the counterattack. As 1944 drew to an end, the U.S. Army in ETO was getting ready to punish the Germans for coming out of their fortifications. The Army had come a long way in the second half of 1944, from the English Channel to the German border. Together with the British and Canadian armies, it had taken the beaches in the greatest amphibious assault in history. It had endured the stalemate in the hedgerow fighting, June and July in Normandy. It had swept through France in a lightning campaign in August. It had outstripped its supply and been forced to stop in September. It had engaged in a long, costly, unnecessary, and unsuccessful offensive through November on into December. It had been caught by surprise and pounded badly in the second half of December. But it had recovered, held, and now was preparing the final offensive. Part 3. Life in ETO. It is not possible to follow the campaign in Northwest Europe without understanding the conditions under which the GIs fought. As always in war, terrain, weather, and enemy firepower dominated the soldiers' lives, especially at night. These and other factors impacted on them throughout the campaign, whether before the breakout in Normandy or during the race to the German border, or while on the defensive in the Ardennes. These factors continued to have an impact through the 1945 fighting and include such things as what it was like to spend a night in a foxhole, the universal praise of the GIs for the Army's medical corps, from medics in the field to the nurses and doctors in the tented hospitals, how bitterly the GIs resented the replacement and reinforcement policies, the terrors and triumphs of the men who fought the war in the skies, the cost paid by those who did their duty because of the ones who didn't. the experience of being a POW. These are themes that run from June 7, 1944 through May 8, 1945. Chapter 10. Night on the Line. In the winter camps of 1864 through 65, Civil War soldiers drilled, marched in closed ranks, built log shelters, repaired equipment, foraged for food. On outpost duty, they swapped tobacco, coffee, and insults with the enemy. At night, they cooked and ate, sang around the campfire, and retired to bunks. Night was the best time for Johnny Reb and Billy Yank. It wasn't like that at all in the winter of 1944 through 45 in Belgium, France, or Luxembourg. Night was the worst time. The difference between 1864 through 65 and 1944 through 45 came about because of technological improvements. Civil War cannon seldom, if ever, fired at night, as the main body of the enemy was out of range, and anyway, Civil War gunners could only fire at what they could see, and then inaccurately. World War II gunners could fire much farther, arching high-trajectory shells in with precise accuracy to hit targets on the other side of the ridge, using a variety of exploding shells. Civil War soldiers had only limited crude mortars. World War II soldiers had a variety of relatively accurate mortars, and their small arms were much more accurate, with much greater range and rate of fire. Civil War soldiers at night could light their pipes, cigars, or cigarettes and gather around a campfire with total security. World War II soldiers hardly dared to have even the smallest fire at the bottom of their foxhole or smoke a cigarette. In the Civil War, communications between the front line and headquarters were by runner only. World War II communications were by handheld radio and, much better, telephone lines running from the front to the command post. Only the most primitive flares, and only a few of them, were available in the Civil War. In World War II, excellent flares and illuminating shells were readily available. In 1944, small handheld bombs, grenades, unavailable in any quantity or sophistication in the Civil War, could be thrown across no man's land, which was in most cases narrower in 1944 through 45 than in 1864 through 65. The internal combustion engine gave armies a nighttime mobility that was not possible with horses. Tanks and self-propelled artillery provided a nighttime firepower far in excess of anything possible 80 years earlier. Combined, the changes in weapons and equipment made World War II commanders far more aggressive at night than Civil War commanders. The people who paid the price for this aggressiveness were the frontline soldiers. In this chapter, I attempt to give some sense of how it was for those who endured and prevailed in the dangerous environment that was life on the front line at night in World War II. Sometimes a major or a lieutenant colonel commanding the battalion, less often a colonel commanding the regiment, very occasionally a brigadier general commanding the division. These were the only visitors to the front lines. Reporters didn't go there, nor did the two-star generals and above. Neither did the traveling entertainers. "I never saw a USO show," Private William Kraft of the 314th Regiment remarked. "I heard they were good, but they didn't come to the front where I was." The front line belonged to the men who worked there, riflemen and machine gunners, mortarmen, forward artillery observers, communications men, and medics. Its depth varied, depending on the terrain, but generally it was about one-half a kilometer. Company CPs were 250 meters or so back from the main line of foxholes and were not considered front line by the riflemen. Private J.A. Strawberry Kraft of the 84th Division defined a member of the rear echelon as "any son of a bitch behind my foxhole." Outposts were anywhere from 10 to 50 meters in front of the line of foxholes. The enemy outposts were sometimes almost within touching distance, more often up to 50 meters away. The friendly OPs were the edge of the known world. Lieutenant Ottz remembered a time in March 1945 when his position was closer to the German foxholes than to his buddies in the holes to the left and right. He could hear the Germans talking so distinctly that he was able to take down their names. They were so close we could hear the clink of the metal and the gurgle of the water as they filled their canteens. Ordinarily, we placed two men to a hole, with one standing guard while the other slept. But here, with our foxholes so far apart and the Germans so close, we found it best to have three men in a hole so two men could be awake at the same time all night. Most of the time, the principal characteristic of the front line was how quiet it was. Artillery boomed in the distance, and the thump of mortars sounded sporadically. But otherwise, unless the enemy was shelling or attacking, there was little noise, nor was there much movement. It was as if the earth had swallowed up all the human beings, as indeed it had, because on the front line, men lived most of the time below the surface. Life-threatening violence was always present. Thousands of eyes searched their perimeters. Thousands of fingers were ready to pull triggers. Thousands of hands were prepared to throw grenades or fire mortars at the slightest motion, or at night, at the least noise or the light of a burning cigarette. In early December, the 84th Division was just inside Germany, near the border with Belgium at Lindern. Private Chalmers Davis, a mortarman, found an observation post on top of a wrecked house. From it, he spotted a haystack moving across an open field. He got on the phone to tell the CP that there was a camouflaged tank out there. Just then, a German soldier jumped out of one foxhole and ran to another. Davis decided to have some fun. "He never should have been out in the daytime," he told his crew, down below behind the house. "He made a mistake." The crew fired two mortar shells and got a bracket on the foxhole. The third shell was a direct hit. A combination of luck and skill was involved, but whatever the cause, the German paid for his mistake with his life. American artillery, meanwhile, got a bracket on the haystack, then knocked out the tank inside. Thus, the first rule of life on the front line: don't move around because someone is watching. Stay in your hole whenever you can. Depending on the length of the line a rifle company was holding, those holes were anywhere from a few to 100 meters apart, occasionally even more. In this, World War II was markedly different from World War I. In the 1914 through 18 conflict, the trench line was continuous. You could walk from the Swiss border to the English Channel without ever showing your head above the earth's surface. The walls were lined with logs. Zigzag trenches ran back from the front to deep in the rear, so food, ammunition, and messages could be brought forward without exposure. To man those extensive trenches, however, took hundreds of thousands of men, indeed millions. In November 1918, Marshal Foch had commanded three times more men than Eisenhower did in November 1944, on a front of approximately the same length. Hindenburg had commanded three to four times more men than Rundstedt. Necessarily, foxholes replaced trenches. Soldiers in the Great War didn't know what a foxhole was. For all the terror of their daily existence, they at least had the comfort of being with comrades, seeing men around them, sensing their own power. World War II soldiers didn't know what trenches were. In their foxholes, they had one, at most two, companions. Otherwise, they felt isolated, as, in fact, in a spread-out company, they were. Compounding the isolation was the unnatural situation of living below the surface of the earth, plus the physical misery of digging a hole big enough for your coffin at the end of an exhausting day. But it had to be done, a lesson quickly learned. Battalions that didn't dig in for the night didn't last long. That should have been learned in training, but it wasn't, so it had to be learned from experience. On June 10th, shortly after midnight, the 2nd Battalion of the 29th Division settled in for the night. The men had just marched 15 miles in the previous 20 hours. Major Maurice Clift, the executive officer, picked out a bivouac area, two enclosed pastures. The men moved into them and slumped against the hedgerow embankments, so exhausted they didn't bother to remove their haversacks. Most were asleep immediately. Few paid attention to the sound of engines, and those who did figured they were American vehicles. But they were German tanks and trucks from the 352nd Division, the outfit the 29th had been fighting since dawn of D-Day. Unknown to either side, the Germans had been retreating in the wake of the advancing 2nd Battalion. German scouts detected the American movement into the pastures. The German column crept forward and surrounded the fields. The Germans fired flares. In the eerie light, almost as bright as midday, they fired assault guns over the hedgerows at the sleeping men. Along one hedgerow, a full platoon rose up, only to be cut down by a burst of machine gun fire. Other frantic Americans dashed to and fro, looking for an escape route. German riflemen cut them down. German mortar shells exploded all around the pastures. GIs fired their M1s wildly at the hedgerows, but they were as likely to hit their own men as Germans. "It was terrible," one survivor reported to General Cota. "We had crawled about 100 yards away from the field when we heard a lot of the guys screaming. I think that the Germans must have been making a bayonet charge." The CO of the 2nd Battalion, Lieutenant Colonel William Warfield, had his CP in a farmhouse on the roadside. He tried to organize a defense, but it was hopeless. Officers who dashed out of the house to get to the field were cut down. A German called out to the headquarters group in English, "Surrender! Surrender!" "Surrender, hell!" Warfield roared back. He tried to lead his small party to the fields where the massacre was taking place, but was immediately killed. The battle lasted only 20 minutes. The battalion suffered 150 casualties, 50 killed, or more than one-third of its total strength. Shortly before dawn, one agonized young lieutenant reporting the disaster to the division commander, General Charles Gerhardt, fell to his knees and pounded the ground with his fists, sobbing that all his men were dead and that he had let them down. Gerhardt was enraged. "No security," he screamed. "They just went into the field and went to bed." From June 10th on, every frontline soldier in the 29th dug a foxhole before going to sleep. So did almost all other American infantrymen. Wherever they were, Private Kurt Gable, 513th PIR, 17th Airborne Division, recalled spending a night in the enormous, beautiful American Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, where the dead from the U.S. Army's biggest World War I battle were buried. It had been meticulously cared for by the Germans during their occupation of France. Gable and his buddy Jake dug their foxhole between two white marble headstones, as did other members of the 513th. Once the men were in their holes, there was no noise, no movement. "All quiet on the Western Front," Jake said. Digging the hole was often arduous, sometimes exhausting. A typical position would be in or on the edge of a wood, which meant many roots, as most of the trees in Belgium were planted in rows, close together. During the second half of December, when the nighttime thermometer began to go down to near or below zero, the ground was frozen to the depth of a foot or more. Pickaxes were hard to come by in the front, and even when available, they weren't much help. Sometimes it took hours to chip away through enough frozen earth to get to unfrozen ground. Men used grenades or satchel charges to blow away the frozen earth. Often, it was just impossible. On the night of December 18th through 19th, near Echternach, Sergeant John Sweeney of the 10th Armored Division tried to dig in. But the ground was made up of heavy, wet clay, and our entrenching shovel couldn't dig into it. After penetrating a few inches, he and his buddies gave up. It was so cold that the rear echelon brought up some heavy overcoats, two for every three soldiers. We placed one overcoat on the ground, and three of us lay on it and covered ourselves with a second overcoat. The only one who was warm was the middle guy, so we changed places every 20 minutes or so. The holes were usually rectangular, under the best conditions 4 or 5 feet deep, 2 or 3 feet wide by 6 feet long. When the men were in them for more than one night, or if they were veterans, they got them covered. Sergeant Leo Lick of the 1st Division, a veteran of Sicily, where he won a Silver Star, and the Normandy invasion, moved into the line near Butkenbach at twilight of December 17th. He and two buddies worked on their hole for a week. They got some logs, which we put over the hole and then put branches over the logs and then covered that layer with soil and camouflaged the top with snow. We also put 6 inches of evergreen needles on the bottom of the hole for comfortable sleeping. The opening to the foxhole also served as a warfare trench from which we could shoot or stand guard. Lick visited the site in 1986 and found the hole still there, an experience I've shared with a number of soldiers who were in the bulge. The cover protected the men from shrapnel and broken branches hurtling down from tree bursts, but there were disadvantages. One night during the opening stages of the bulge, Private Richard Jepson, who stayed in the Army, got a post-war commission and retired as a full colonel of the 30th Infantry Division, was in a well-covered foxhole with a buddy. It got to 10 below zero Fahrenheit, and then it started to rain. Our body heat had risen into the overhead covering, and the snow and ice were beginning to melt and drip on us. During an advance, lucky GIs frequently were able to occupy holes abandoned by the retreating Germans. Nearly always they were deeper and better protected than ones made by Americans. Sometimes this was because the Germans were able to utilize slave labor to dig. More often it was because the Wehrmacht supplied better tools to its men than did the U.S. Army, and because in many cases the German soldiers were more strictly disciplined. Lieutenant Otz recalled, "The best foxhole I ever stayed in. The Germans had dug it about 7 by 5 by 10 feet deep, with a covering of 6-inch logs, dirt, and snow. It had a little gasoline stove, a candle, and a bottle gas lamp, so we really had most of the comforts of home." Once the holes were dug, the next task was to secure the area with booby traps, wires stretched across a path, or any opening in no man's land attached to grenades. Next, the men set out landmines. Between the booby traps and the main line of foxholes, the men dug holes for outposts to be occupied by sentries. Then they set up communications, COMO, which meant running telephone lines back to the CP. Telephones were more reliable and secure than the handheld radios, and in any case, the breath from a man speaking into the radio would condense and freeze on the diaphragms of the radio microphones. On the other hand, telephone lines got cut by enemy shelling. If at all possible, the quartermasters would try to get bedrolls up to the men before full dark, bringing them forward on jeeps. The bedrolls were one half a canvas pup tent, which then, buttoned to the other half, became a tent, although seldom did GIs set up a tent on the front, as it was far too conspicuous, wrapped around two wool blankets or a sleeping bag. The bag was much warmer, but more dangerous, because it was harder to get out of it if an enemy patrol or attack required instant action. The cooks would try to get a hot meal up to the front before dark. This could be extremely dangerous, however, especially when taking up a new position, because the enemy might have observation posts. During the third week of December, Private Gable and the 513th PIR moved into the front line in Belgium. After the foxholes were dug, the booby traps set, and the communications lines strung, Gable was amazed by two things: how quiet it was, and the sudden unexpected appearance of the cooks with marmite cans and hot food. The men grabbed their mess kits and got into a chow line, "like all the other chow lines from Fort Benning to Neuchâteau," Gable noted. "Get those men spread out!" a lieutenant yelled at his NCOs. But before anyone could move, there was an explosion, then another, and another. German 88s traveled faster than the speed of sound, so the GIs didn't hear the whoosh before the explosion. Cries of "Medic!" intermingled with the lieutenant's order, "Back to your holes! Take cover!" Four more shells exploded before the men reached their holes. The 513th PIR got a quick, if expensive, lesson in the cost of bunching up when the Germans could be watching. Mostly, American soldiers stayed in their foxholes where they ate cold C and K rations. Germans had hard black bread and, if lucky, sausage and butter. Just one night in a foxhole in Belgium in December 1944 was memorable. 10, 20, 30 nights was hell. To begin with, night lasted so long in those northern latitudes. Dusk began to come on around 1600 or 1615. By 1645, it was full dark. First light didn't come up for 16 hours. It was bitterly cold, even for the GIs from Montana or North Dakota. It was frequently below zero and generally damp, with low clouds blowing in from the North Sea and a fog that penetrated everywhere, when it wasn't snowing. Then the wind blew like a gale, driving the pellets of snow into their faces. It was Northern Europe's coldest winter in 40 years. Colonel Ralph Ingersoll, the creator of the Talk of the Town for the New Yorker magazine, was an intelligence officer with First Army. He described the cold. "Riding in a jeep through the Ardennes, I wore woolen underwear, a woolen uniform, armored force combat overalls, a sweater, an armored force field jacket with elastic cuffs, a muffler, a heavy lined trench coat, two pairs of heavy woolen socks, and combat boots with galoshes over them. And I cannot remember ever being warm." Ingersoll was lucky. Although it was windy in the open jeep, it was dry, and he was much better dressed for the cold than any GI on the line. The infantrymen's clothing was woefully, even criminally, inadequate. As noted, this was because of a command decision General Bradley had made in September. He had decided to keep weapons, ammunition, food, and replacements moving forward at the expense of winter clothing, betting that the campaign would be over before December. As a consequence, the men in the holes had few of the items Ingersoll wore. Their footwear, leather combat boots, were almost worse than useless. Whenever the temperature went above freezing, they were standing in 2 to 20 inches of water, which the leather soaked up. There were good boots available in Europe, of the type made popular by L.L. Bean after the war, well-insulated with leather uppers but rubber bottoms. But to the everlasting disgrace of the quartermasters and all other rear echelon personnel, who were nearly all wearing them by mid-December, not until late January did the boots get to where they were needed. Major General Paul Hawley, the chief surgeon for ETO, commented bluntly, "The plain truth is that the footwear furnished U.S. troops is lousy." 3 days before the bulge began, Colonel Ken Reimers of the 90th Division noted that, "Every day more men are falling out due to trench foot. Some men are so bad they can't wear shoes and are wearing overshoes over their socks. These men can't walk and are being carried from sheltered pillbox positions at night to firing positions in the daytime." In place of boots, the men got directives on how to prevent trench foot. They were ordered to massage their feet and change their socks every day. Sergeant Lick recalled, "We would remove our wet socks, hang them around our neck to dry, massage our feet, and then put on the dry socks from around our neck that we had put there the day before. Then a directive came down stating that anyone getting trench foot would be tried by court-martial." Senior officers threatened court-martial to men who got trench foot, or took disciplinary action against junior officers whose units had a high incidence of the malady, because they suspected the foxhole dwellers were getting it deliberately. They thought it was almost the equivalent of a self-inflicted wound. The best way to avoid trench foot was to lace the boots lightly and take them off at night before climbing into the sleeping bag or covering yourself with a blanket. But Lick said, "We couldn't take our boots off when we slept because they would freeze solid and we couldn't get them on again in the morning." The obvious solution, quickly learned by thousands of men, was to take the boots off but keep them inside the sleeping bag. Still, there was another reason for keeping the boots on, the possible need for instant action. Men wrapped their feet in burlap sacks when available, but the burlap soaked up the snow, so the boots got soggy, the socks got wet. Sergeant Lick lost all his toenails, but through regular massages and a rotation of his socks, he avoided trench foot. Thousands of others got it. Trench foot put more men out of action than German 88s, mortars, or machine gun fire. During the winter of 1944 through 45, some 45,000 men had to be pulled out of the front line because of trench foot, the equivalent of 3 full infantry divisions. First, a man lost his toenails. His feet turned white, then purple, finally black. A serious case of trench foot made walking impossible. Many men lost their toes. Some had to have their feet amputated. If gangrene set in, the doctors had to amputate the lower leg. It has to be doubted that many men did this deliberately. A shot in the foot was much quicker, less dangerous, and nearly impossible to prove that it hadn't been an accident. One private in Lieutenant Otz's platoon shot himself in the foot, and there was no question of accident. The man had been talking all night to his mate, Private Von Rose Lacrone, about doing it. Lacrone had the flu and was so depressed he just wanted the guy to shut up, so he told him to go ahead and do it. Egger commented, "It was 3 miles by trail to the aid station. The 2 medics who went with him made him walk all the way. There was no free ride for those with self-inflicted wounds." During those long nights, it was impossible to keep out of the mind the thought of how easy it would be to shoot around into the foot. Sergeant Egger considered it, but, "I did not have the nerve to shoot myself. I thought about dropping a case of rations on my foot, but I did not want to live the rest of my life with that on my mind. I decided to stick it out and trust in the Lord." A man in Lieutenant Linebaugh's platoon begged his squad leader, "Do me a favor, Sergeant. Shoot me in the leg." Captain Roland of the 99th Division recalled,
"Men began to wound themselves one way or another in order to get away from the front. Sometimes this was intentional. Sometimes it occurred through a gross negligence born of fear, exhaustion, and misery."
"There were two things in front of you always," Corporal Claire Galdonick of the 90th Division remarked. "The enemy and death. Sometimes morale was so low that you preferred death instead of a day-by-day agonizing existence. When you were wet, cold, hungry, lonely, death looked very inviting. It was always close at hand, and I found myself being envious of a dead comrade. At least he suffered no more physically or mentally."
Private Bert Morphis of the 1st Division remembered that on Christmas Eve he was
on an outpost right in front of the German lines, where the choice seemed to be between moving and being shot, or lying perfectly still and freezing to death.
Most of them stuck it out. Dutch Schultz of the 82nd Airborne was one of hundreds who refused to be evacuated because of trench foot. But when he also came down with dysentery and the flu, his CO ordered him to the rear. He commented,
"I secretly experienced a great deal of guilt about going to the hospital for anything other than a bona fide wound. Anemia, bronchitis, dysentery, and trench foot seemed to be an easy way out. In hindsight, I understand that if you are sick, you don't belong on a battlefield. But when you are an immature kid trying to be a hero, it is something of a problem, particularly when you're trying to prove your courage to no one other than yourself."
Getting out of there, honorably, was every man's dream. Thus the expression, million-dollar wound. Sergeant John Sabia took 5 machine gun bullets in his right thigh. His CO asked if he could make it back to the aid station on his own, as the company couldn't spare a man.
"Hell yes, I can do it."
Sabia took a limb to use as a crutch and began hopping awkwardly in the snow. After 10 meters, he stopped, turned around, waved his limb in a gesture of defiance and exuberance, and bellowed at his buddies in their holes,
"Hey, you bastards! Clean sheets! Clean sheets!"
Private Donald Shue of the 80th Infantry Division recalled seeing one of his buddies, named Stehorst, take a hit from an 88 that blew off his hand.
"He was crying and running around yelling, 'I'm going home! Thank you, God, I'm going home!'"
Stehorst was lucky, at least according to the standards of the men of the Bulge, and specifically to Sergeant Richard Wallace of the 90th Division. After one shelling, Wallace told his squad,
"Boys, I'd give my right arm up to here," holding it at his elbow, "if this war would end right now."
The shelling resumed. Shrapnel tore into Wallace's face.
"I can't see," he cried out. "I can't see. Oh, my God, I'm blind."
He never saw again, and the war was a long way from over. Sleep deprivation was a universal experience. 2, 3, at most 4 hours of fitful sleep was about it. But no matter how sleepy a man was, he lived in constant tension. The men in the front line shivered in their foxholes, attempting to stay alert, straining to see, straining to hear, straining to stay awake. They would chew gum or tobacco. Private Ken Russell of the 82nd Airborne remembered chewing one or the other very slowly. "I didn't want to finish too quickly and have nothing to do but think of the precarious position I was in." Lieutenant Glenn Gray, in his classic book, The Warriors, calls this the tyranny of the present. In a foxhole, the past and, more important, the future do not exist. The only thing in the world that matters is the moment. Gray says that there is more time for thinking and more loneliness in foxholes than anywhere else, and time is measured in other ways than by clocks and calendars. Private Dave Nutt of the 99th Division recalled,
"The cold, the snow, and the darkness were enough to set young nerves on edge. The thud of something as innocuous as snow plopping to the ground from a tree branch could be terrifying. Was it snow? Was it maybe a German patrol? Should you fire at the sound and risk giving away your position? Or worse, hitting one of your own men? But did the Germans have us surrounded?"
Lieutenant Ott's heard a thud one night and went out to investigate in the morning. He found a dying German soldier who murmured over and over,
"Oh, God, I meant no harm. I meant no harm."
The boy was unarmed and wore no helmet, so he may well have been coming in to surrender when he set off the booby trap. But the Germans often went on patrols unarmed, so if they were captured, they could say they were coming in to give up. Ott's commented,
"I imagine quite a few Germans would have surrendered, but it was impossible in the daytime, as their own men would shoot them. And at night, they were afraid to try to run our gauntlet of booby traps and machine guns."
An experience shared by many foxhole soldiers was the screaming of a wounded man in front of the outposts. Ott's recalled,
"A hell of a night. Someone out in front of us was screaming, 'Help! Help! Can't you hear me? For God's sake, help!' This went on all night. You can't imagine what it does to you to be sitting in a foxhole with the black night all around and someone yelling for help in a mournful voice."
Ott's knew that there were American wounded out front, but he also knew that the Germans used such calls to trick the GIs and would ambush anyone going out to give aid, so he ordered his platoon to stay put. Tension was at its most pronounced when changing guard. Every 2 hours, the platoon sergeants would get 2 men from a foxhole and lead them to the outpost position to relieve the men on duty.
"The trip out to the OP was always eerie," Sergeant Burton Christensen of the 101st Airborne remembered of his nights outside Bastogne. "You eyed all silhouettes suspiciously, skeptical of any sound. Reluctantly, you approach the OP. The silhouettes of the men in their positions are not clear. Are they Germans? The suspense is always the same. Then, finally, you recognize an American helmet. Feeling a little ridiculous, yet also relieved, you change the guard, turn around, and return to the main line, only to repeat the entire process in another 2 hours. You always slept with one eye open," Private Arnold Lindblad of the 104th Medical Battalion recalled. "Unless you were on duty, you hit the hole when it got dark and stayed there till full light. There was no walking around in the dark, no talking from hole to hole. You never got used to it." On his first night in a foxhole, Private Richard Hoyer, a replacement with the 84th Division, was suffering from dysentery. "I didn't want to crap in my helmet," he related, "so I decided I'd crawl outside at night." As he wore 2 pairs of long johns beneath his wool pants, it was a real chore getting down to the point where I could do my duty. As I was doing my duty, I heard some noises behind me, and I thought they were Germans. I jumped into the hole without pulling my drawers up. That really startled my foxhole buddy. I had crapped in the first pair of drawers, so I had to stand there in the middle of the foxhole and cut it out. This wasn't easy because I had to do the cutting with my bayonet."
This ends Disc 9.